Hebrews 11 and 8. By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith also Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore innumerable. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac, and he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. By faith Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. By faith Jacob, when he was a dying, blessed both the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning upon the top of his staff. By faith Joseph, when he died, made mention of the exodus of the children of Israel, and gave commandment concerning his bones. May God bless to us the further reading of Holy Scripture. You know that we're spending the week with an anonymous letter. Not merely do we not know its writer, but there's no mention of the folks to whom it was addressed. And while it contains many quotations, none of them is attributed to any human. The only writer mentioned is the blessed Spirit of God. But what we do know of the addressees is that they were great believers in an earthly priest, and they were devoted to an earthly temple, and they were equally devoted to an earthly city, and very fond of literal animal sacrifices. And I take it that that was the great problem which the writer had, weaning them away from the visible to the invisible, from the tangible to the intangible. For of course, human hearts crave for what is seen, for what is capable of being touched. And the writer is frequently pleading with them to go on to the real things that lie behind the scene. For, as we have been reminded, the things which are seen are temporal. It's the things which are not seen that are eternal. And if there's one big message that's written over the Epistle to the Hebrews for me, it's just this, that things are nonetheless real for being invisible. They're all the more lasting for being invisible. And I take it the writer is pleading with these people constantly and saying, look, in accepting Christ, you're losing nothing. You're gaining everything. And I take it that's why this great chapter comes in where it does in the letter to the Hebrews. The apostle isn't changing the subject. He's just reminding them that they follow in a noble tradition, that the folks whose names they revered lived according to the principle of faith that he was extolling. And so their other names arrayed for us, and we could easily hear the words of chapter 12 brought in, whose faith follow. You know, I like to look at these opening verses in the Gospel, almost in similar fashion to that of our brother Albert. Faith in Abel believed in a sacrifice for sins. Faith in Enoch believed in a way through death. Faith in Noah believed in escape from coming judgment. And of course, we'll have to spend a little time with a man whose faith believed in another country. And you know what country that is? A better country. That is in heavenly. But can we make a few remarks of a more general nature before we come to it? The first thing I want you to note about the chapter as a whole is that faith introduces another dimension, one not known in this world. I'm interested in the knots that appear in the chapter. It's their very presence that causes me to say faith believes in another dimension, an extra one not known down here. Things not seen, not made of things which do appear, not see death, not seen as yet, not knowing whither he went, not having received, and one that's tantamount equally to being a negative, past age. Faith ignores negatives. Faith introduces another dimension. Or if you like, you might look at example after example within the chapter and say, faith ignores death. We humans can't ignore it. It's awfully real, awfully final, isn't it? Oh, what a halt it brings to many a business, many a career. But faith ignores death. You can see that one right throughout the chapter, can't you? Being dead, yet speaketh. Translated that he should not see death. Sprang there even of one and him as good as dead. Died in faith, not having received the promises. Able to raise him up even from the dead. When he was a dying, when he died, made mention. Women received their dead. Beloved, we are in the presence of the greatest factor in the world. One that introduces another dimension not known down here. One that ignores death. One that knows no obstacles. And that's really what we're going to look at. The way in which, in the careers of these people about whom we have been reading, faith knew no obstacles. You could look at the whole of the list within the chapter from this point of view. I mean, back to verse 1 in thought again, and you'll find it again in verse 27. Why faith sees the invisible. Invisibility is no obstacle to faith. Of course, we've already had it brought to our notice. Faith explains creation. There's no such obstacle in the pathway of faith. Faith transcends death. Faith knows the future. Faith doesn't fear the unknown. Faith spans the centuries and embraces eternity. So that there are just no obstacles to faith. We realize that no matter how sweeping the statements we make, they are simply not beyond the reach of faith. And so that is the great example that the apostle brings to these Hebrews in illustration after illustration. We think of Abraham, who is the first of the great characters whom we are to consider. And I was saying a few moments ago that as far as Abraham was concerned, he believed in another country. Of course, he didn't behave in the usual human fashion. An idolater yonder in the Middle East, the God of glory appeared to him. And he said to him, Abraham, get out of your country. Get away from your father's house, from your kindred, into a land that I will tell thee of. And of course, we would have wanted to make all the necessary preparations. Look it up on the map. Get hold of somebody who could tell us something about it. Somebody who had been there before. But Abraham just didn't do that. He went out, not knowing whither he went. He believed in another country. I take it that's the situation in which we're put. Heaven, where is it? Which of us is able to tell, to say we've met somebody who can describe it to us? And yet, is very real to faith, isn't it? It's not unknown to faith. We believe in another country. And if worldly wise men were to demand a knowledge of its location and ask us to tell us just where it is in the universe, why we go back to this great chapter and we say, look, it's a heavenly country. And far from our faith in it being upset by our seeming ignorance of it, why would Justin insist, look, it's all the better for being heavenly. It's not subject to the restrictions of earth. It's not subject to the circumstances of earth. Not subject to the limitations of earth. And so there's a very choice paragraph within our chapter telling us something more about that city, that country. Can we pause just for a moment? What was it that these Hebrews were looking for? Methinks it's summed up in three different ideas you'll find within the letter. We've been reading about the promises. There's a tremendous collection of them, especially in the book of Genesis. I suppose they might be summed up in all of the Old Testament covenants. A collection of the promises of God for His people. And that's what these heroes of faith were waiting for. The fulfillment of God's promises. Now there's another word that comes up very, very frequently throughout the epistle. It's the word perfection. The word completeness. I've enjoyed engaging in the study of that particular word. And in Hebrews chapter 11, why we're introduced to folks who were waiting for this completeness. In fact, by one offering. The Lord Jesus hath perfected forever them that are sanctified. Or again, the third of these ideas is just this one of a city or a country. You know, the apostle speaks about both. And from one point of view, this book, I mean the Bible, could be called the search for a city. And certainly that's how the life of Abraham could be viewed. Well, he went out not knowing whither he went, looking for the land that God had spoken to him of. He became a pilgrim in it. He never settled down. He was more intent on reaching God's country, the land of his choice for him, than he was settling down here. Of course, he was called Abraham the Hebrew. You know the simple meaning of that word? The passer through. The man who never settled down. You mustn't think that Abraham was poor. The book of Genesis would tell you just the opposite. Far from detracting from his pilgrim character, that should enhance it. For the big point was this, that there would have been every inducement for a man as wealthy as an Abraham to settle down, but this world was not his home. He was just a passing through. And so because he believed in another country, he just refused to settle down there. The only things he ever built were altars. For the rest, he pitched his tent. Couldn't we be doing with some imitation of his faith in our century? Why, here was a man who believed in another country. Do you merely relish it from the point of view of a rest for your soul after life's little day is done? Or is it so real to you that it affects your whole outlook upon this particular world? We went out not knowing whither he went. He sojourned in the land of promise as in a strange country. He was looking for another city, one that wasn't of this creation, one that wasn't of man's building. And you can read with delight many of the precious things that God's book tells us about that particular city. We come to his wife, for she is mentioned too in the list of the heroes of faith. She received strength to conceive seed. It wasn't the barrier of an unknown country that lay in her path. It was the barrier of barrenness. You know, the promises of God were first vested in Abraham. And there didn't seem much point in possessing them if he couldn't pass them on to his heirs. But he had none. And his wife was barren, so that there weren't likely to be any. And the years are rolling on. I take it that it was trebly impossible for Sarah to have a son at the finish up. There was first of all the obstacle of her barrenness. If that hadn't been there, there was the obstacle of her age. And there was the obstacle of his age as well. Does one keep clinging to the promises of God in spite of all the appearances to the contrary? Can faith surmount obstacles like these, which are seemingly insurmountable? Well, you know the answer. She received strength to conceive seed. Remember the Apostle Paul's description of it in Romans chapter 4, who against hope believed in hope. Faith knows no obstacles. Sarah's barrenness was no obstacle to faith. Abraham's age, Sarah's age, was no obstacle to faith. The result was that she was delivered of a child when she was past age. And the big reason was just this. She judged him faithful who had promised. And that's how we are expected to receive the promises of God. Just say, God is faithful. He's able to do it. Never mind the obstacle. Well, of course, there is a parallel birth in the New Testament, isn't there? There is another man whose birth was a treble impossibility. And then, best of all, there was the birth of our glorious Lord, which was a greater miracle even still. But that was no obstacle to the faith of an Abraham and of a Sarah. Faith knows none. But then, of course, there was another great trial of Abraham's faith. I'm jumping the passage to which we've been referring back and forward, the passage that tells us about the country, the city. I'm thinking now of the obstacle to the realization of the promises of God for Abraham, posed by that terrible day in Genesis chapter 22, when God said to Abraham, "Take now thy son, thine only Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into a mountain that I will tell thee of." Ah yes, you know the details. Here was surely the supreme test of Abraham's faith. The obstacle of a sacrifice, of a divine requirement that he surrender the son in whom all his hopes were pinned. The son who was to be the heir to those promises. And you might say, surely by that time, Abraham had learned to trust his God in such absolute fashion that he would be able to say, yes, the God who performed that tremendous miracle of giving me Isaac is able to give me another. You know, that wasn't possible in this situation. Take now thy son, thine only Isaac. You see, faith doesn't work the same way the second time. Wouldn't be faith. You listen to the Lord's servant telling you of the remarkable way in which the Lord met his needs in the strangest of fashions. Maybe he'll do it next month in the same way. Well, if he did, it wouldn't require faith. Experience would be such by that time that you would say, I know how it's going to happen. Ah, the sparing of Isaac was quite different from the provision of Isaac. And of course, here was Isaac raised from the dead, so to speak. From it, he received him in a figure. You know, God was thrilled with Abraham that day. That's what we're reading about, and what we might have read about in the early verses of chapter 6. Surely blessing, I will bless thee. And multiplying, I will multiply thee. By myself have I sworn. And so there were the promises of God, doubly guaranteed, by two immutable things in which it was impossible for God to lie. That's the kind of hold that faith acquires on God. So faith didn't know even the obstacle of Isaac's sacrifice as being too much in its way. God was able to raise him up from the dead. Did we not say already that faith ignores death? We move on to Isaac, and perhaps we should just lump Isaac and Jacob from this point of view together. For the little bit that we're told about each had reference to the future concerning things to come. Or you say, the future's an unknown way as far as I'm concerned. There are times when I long to know what it holds for me. The future's an obstacle, an enigma, a mystery. But faith doesn't even know that as an obstacle. I shall know him, we sometimes think. We have assurance, haven't we? We ended up on a happy note this afternoon. We know that the forerunner has already arrived for us within the veil, and we're going there too. So that the unknown future is no obstacle to faith. Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau concerning things to come. Humans can't speak with any certainty about the future. They make forecasts, economic, social, all kinds, and they go haywire. But faith doesn't know that kind of obstacle at all. Jacob, in turn, gathered his sons round his bed. I don't know whether you've listened to a series of addresses on them or not. Why, they made prophecies, didn't they? They spoke with certainty about the future. To faith, the future is not an unknown way. Wasn't that what we're hearing about from the beginning of the chapter? Faith is the substance of things hoped for. Faith is the evidence of things not seen. We claim what we're promised as though we already had it. We grasp the future with firm hand. Faith doesn't regard the unknown future with fear and dread at all. Faith grasps the future as though it were already here. And then we finish up with Joseph, that remarkable character who has fascinated us from boyhood days. He made mention of the exodus of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. You know that none of the patriarchs was buried in Egypt, don't you? They refused to be. But you know, the interesting thing was this, that while Jacob was carried back to his own land, the land of promise, as soon as he died, Joseph didn't allow that. No, he gave commandment concerning his bones. Embalm my body. You know, the beauty of the book is that it puts the story of embalmment of a body in the only land of the ancient world in which it was known. And there, for all those centuries, the children of Israel had an unburied body, an unburied coffin in their midst. What did it all mean? You know, it was a guarantee of the exodus of the children of Israel. He believed in that country about which we're speaking. When the children of Israel set out for Canaan, they carried two arks with them. Aye, the Hebrew word for coffin is the same word as for ark. One was the guarantee that they would reach the end of the journey. The other was the guarantee of the divine presence all the time they would be in the journey. And it's just the same today. Why, there was that unburied coffin in Egypt as a guarantee that one day the bondage would cease. One day they would be redeemed. One day the groaning would pass away and they would set out for their own land, the land long since promised by the God who is faithful. And so, why this whole collection of them believed in that other country? I'm wondering if from the practical point of view we do. You know, I have a great deal of sympathy with a Christian philanthropist. Have none whatever with a Christian politician who tries to improve the country in which he is, instead of fascinating his attention on the other country, the heavenly, the one about which such lovely things are said in our chapter. Beloved, faith knows no obstacles. It grasps the unseen and claims it for its very own. And so the writer is just saying, look, I'm asking you to accept a great high priest pass through the heavens. You can't see him, but he's real, very real. He's incapable of being touched by death like all of those others. I'm asking you to accept and enter a heavenly sanctuary. It will never be destroyed as old Jerusalem was. I'm asking you to set out for a heavenly city. I'm asking you to look forward right till the end of the epistle to offer spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Jesus Christ. With such he's well pleased. I'm asking you to step out in the noble pathway of those who walked and lived by faith.